Welcome aboard, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Stephen Dubner. On behalf of the entire crew here at Freakonomics Radio, I'd like to thank you for choosing this program. We know you have a choice of programs when you listen, and we want to thank you for choosing us. This is episode number 632, originating out of WNYC Studios in New York City. Our playing time today will be approximately 1 hour, and our guest today is a very talkative airline pilot.
My name is Patrick Smith.
And he will answer my questions about flying and yours.
Is it true that pilots can see you through a camera that's in the bathroom?
Can the pilot really fly faster? And if so, why don't they fly faster normally as a normal matter of course?
Is there anything that you have seen while on a flight that you couldn't explain?
It's time now to sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Feel free to move about the cabin as soon as you hear the...
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything, with your host, Stephen Dubner.
Never underestimate the contempt people have for airlines. People hate carriers, and you know, the airlines are out to either steal your money or get you killed or both. So as part of this, let me apologize in advance for sounding frustrated.
Patrick Smith is a pilot for a major U.S. carrier. He won't say which one.
I live near Boston, and I fly the Boeing 757 and 767 aircraft.
And he's willing to tell you everything he knows about airline travel. Smith maintains a website called askthepilot.com.
And my book is called Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel.
His love for flying came early.
When I was a kid, I used to stay up at night, instead of doing my homework, reading airline timetables and looking at the route maps and all the countries and cities that these airplanes flew to.
And while Smith gets the fact that most of us love to whinge about airline travel, he doesn't see it that way.
It's still a very special thing and still an exciting thing in a lot of ways that people don't normally think about. There's so much bad information out there. There are so many urban myths and conspiracy theories and all these ideas people have about the airlines and about flying, so many of which are wrong.
Give me a for instance. What's top on your list of urban airline myths?
Oh, where can we start? We can talk about the notion people have that flying is expensive when, in fact, it's cheaper than it's ever been. It's absurdly cheap in a lot of ways. Young people especially have no memory of the fact that not all that long ago, only a certain fraction of the population could afford to fly at all. And now it's basically a form of mass transit. And, you know, that's good. The downside is that it's crowded, it's noisy, planes are full, there are babies crying, and then you don't get a three-course meal in economy anymore. So it's good and bad, give and take. But flying is damn cheap when you adjust for inflation, and even when you factor in all of those ancillary fees that airlines love and passengers hate, airfares are about half of what they were 30 years ago. So flying is cheap, and it's mostly reliable. About 85% of flights get to where they're going on time. And then you've got kind of the more romantic side of it. You know, the idea that you can get on a wide-body jet in New York City and fly to China in 13, 14 hours, you know, something that 100 years ago would have been absolutely unimaginable to people. And you can do that for a few pennies per mile. You know, people don't often stop and kind of meditate on that because it's corny, but it is true and it's kind of exciting.
It seems to me, at least, that people love to hate on the airline industry and that it's considered perfectly standard to hate on the airline industry. But it is strange that we don't hate on movie studios who make plenty of crappy movies, and we don't complain about our electric utility suppliers, which and electricity has gotten a lot more expensive, in, at least in many parts of the country, relative to other costs than airline travel. What is it, do you think, that makes your industry such a target for just kind of low-grade fever whining of a standard sort?
I think part of it is fear. The fact that on some level people are afraid when they get on a plane, and then that is compounded by, let's be frank, the recalcitrance of airlines. Airlines don't like to talk. They don't like to give out answers if they don't have to. They don't like to explain problems, sometimes safety issues. They don't need to because people aren't going to stop flying, but they will continue to hate it. So I think that feeds into the contempt that people have for the flying experience. And also, look, it is uncomfortable most of the time. It can be exciting if you're flying from New York to Hong Kong in business class, but if you're going from St. Louis to Denver in the back of a 737, yeah, it sucks. But for all of the griping people do about being wedged in steerage, I was on a flight not long ago. I'm in economy. I've got a 12-inch video screen with 100 and something movies to pick from, TV shows to watch. I've got a little coat hook. I've got a, I wouldn't call it a designer seat, but, kind of an advanced, sculpted economy seat. It was pretty comfortable. And I think back to the 1970s when I flew as a kid and you had a seat. And remember those movies that you would watch on the bulkhead screen that were all blurry and they would give you the plastic earphones that you'd stick in your ear and it would like cut the inside of your ear because the plastic always had jagged edges on it. People talk about, I wish flying could be the way it used to be. Are you sure? I mean, do you really want to go back to that and also to the fact that flying was more dangerous and more expensive?
So you're a smart guy. You're also an airline pilot. You understand that people get upset about anomalous events when they're presented in a certain way. But do you blame them for being scared? It's a strange thing to climb into a big metal tube and let a couple people fly across the country.
It is. And I think on some level, everybody is afraid to fly. And maybe they have a reason to be. But we've engineered out, what used to be all the most common causes of accidents. First, you have improved technology, cockpit technology, improved airport infrastructure and so on. Better crew training, pilot training. And then, for example, a lot of carriers now have these self-reporting programs where pilots, when they make a mistake, you write it up, you send it in. You're not punished, but that data is collected and analyzed both by the airline and by the regulators to look for trends and take preemptive action to stop worse things from happening. And it works very well. We're much safer now than we used to be. You can do the statistics differently, but I've heard, 8 times, 9 times, 10 times safer than we were 30 years ago, even with double the number of airplanes in the sky. Go back to the year 1985, for example. In that 1 year, there were 27 major airline disasters around the world that killed, 2,000 or so people. 27. And you had, among those, you had two of the deadliest air disasters in history happening within 60 days of each other. Granted, that was an unusually bad year, but we had years like that all the time where you had multiple catastrophes globally each year, and we don't see that anymore. But you almost wouldn't know that because every time there's an incident, it's splashed across, all these different media platforms 24/7. And I think that gives people the idea that these things are happening more commonly than they are.
What about, however, the pool of pilots among big planes and big airlines and regional jets?
Great question. We keep hearing about this pilot shortage. Really, this is something affecting the regional sector, not the mainline sector. And where it comes from is the fact that for years and years and years, regional airline pilots were paid next to nothing. And pilots were suddenly realizing, wait a minute, I'm going to put $200,000 into my training to make $20,000 a year as a regional airline co-pilot? No. And so fewer people getting into the business and the ranks are drying up. So it's the regionals that are having trouble attracting pilots. We are seeing salaries starting to go up. Some carriers are offering bonuses and that kind of thing.
What about salaries among the big companies, including yours? For instance, you want to tell us your salary? You're certainly welcome to if you'd like.
No, I don't. But I will say that I do well. I do better than I ever expected to. And I have no complaints about my job. I love my job. But it took a long time to get to where I am. And when I started flying regional planes in 1990, I was making $850 a month gross pay. Even as a regional airline captain in the mid-90s, I was making $36,000 a year. This after, me and my family put tens and tens of thousands of dollars into my training, and I was just getting no return on that investment at all. It wasn't until I was in my 40s that I finally made a six-figure income. So it takes a while to get to that level, and for many pilots, they never do. And this is another reason you're seeing fewer pilots getting into the business, because the regional sector, the lower-paying regional sector, has gotten so big. It's no longer seen as just a stepping stone to a major carrier. When I was learning to fly, you did your training, you went to work for a regional for a couple of years, and then you went on to a major. That was the process.
So now it's become more of a tournament model, yeah, where you're not guaranteed at all ascension to the major level?
Right. And regional pilots are sitting back and thinking, hey, this might be as far as I ever get. This is a career. It's not a stepping stone. And so for that reason, fewer are willing to do it.
But I think we could agree that the pilot as a profession, including regional and major airlines, is not as financially attractive as it used to be, correct?
That is correct. Pilots do not make as much money as they used to make.
So are you concerned that as those salaries have fallen, relative at least to other occupations, that the occupation will attract either fewer or less competent pilots over time?
Haven't you heard, Stephen, that pilots are going to disappear soon and we're all going to be flying around on pilotless aircraft?
Well, that's my hope. No offense to you. I do know that autonomous cars are a potential reality. And I like the ramifications of that because I think that driving and riding in cars is one of the single most dangerous things that a given human will do on a regular basis. So talk to me for a moment about why I shouldn't expect and fully demand all my planes be flown by robots and computers.
Well, a car is not an airplane. Do I need to say that? You know, neither is a drone. And I know it's so easy to compare the two. And you look at a drone and you extrapolate and we'll just make it bigger and put 100 seats on it. And there you go. But then you look at the safety record of drones and you think, wait a minute. Almost always when this comes up, the people advocating for the pilotless plane idea are academics, researchers, scientists, and so on. And, you know, granted, the work these people do, it's important, it's interesting, it's compelling. But the people you hear talking about this aren't people who necessarily have a good grasp of the operational realities of commercial flying. All right, I'm an airline pilot, so I'm an advocate. I'm defending my profession and all of that. It's, you know, but that's not it. I mean, I personally don't care if eventually pilotless planes are a reality because I'll be long dead and retired before then. I'm not saying it's something we can't do, just as we could be living on cities on Mars. It's within our technological grasp, but that doesn't mean it's affordable, practical, or something that we really want. You know, I think of all of the thousands of things that could go wrong on any commercial flight. And do you really want to be dealing with those problems from a room thousands of miles away? I'm astounded by how much faith people have in this idea. And, you know, among the challenges, never mind the technological challenges, which are huge, you'd basically have to rebuild the entire civil aviation infrastructure from air traffic control to the way airports are laid out, hundreds of billions of dollars to make something like that happen. And you'd still have to have pilots to fly the airplanes just from a remote location. You're talking so many years and so much research and so much technological advance before this could happen. You'll be getting into a pilotless commercial jet around the time that you'll be getting a doctorless kidney transplant.
It seems we've struck a nerve with our pilot friend. So, coming up on Freakonomics Radio, we'll poke him a bit more on the topic of cockpit automation.
Where to begin on this, Stephen? This is one of my favorite slash least favorite things to talk about.
We'll also hear some of your questions.
How effective are aviation security measures at stopping terrorism? And if you were in charge, what would you do differently?
And if you're flying soon and you need to load up your mobile devices with listening material, why don't you get yourself over to iTunes and subscribe to Freakonomics Radio. You can also find our entire archive on Freakonomics.com, along with transcripts for every episode, as well as music credits and lots more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Patrick Smith is an airline pilot with a website called AskThePilot.com and a book called Cockpit Confidential. He grew up near Boston.
One of the things my friends and I used to do during junior high school was we would take the subway out to Logan Airport in Boston. And we would, back in those days, of course, you could just walk through security without a ticket. And we would stake out the jetway when a flight came in. And after all the passengers were off, we would walk down the jetway and approach one of the pilots or flight attendants and say, hey, is it okay if we come in and look at the cockpit? And almost always the answer was, sure, come on. And we would go up to the cockpit and sit in the pilot's chairs and pretend we were, you know, up in the air over the ocean somewhere. That was a pretty big thrill for a seventh grader, an eighth grader. I remember one time We spent an hour in the cockpit of the Northwest Airlines DC-10 at Logan Airport, and absolutely nobody knew we were there. Finally, a mechanic came along. You know, what the hell are you kids doing? We're like, well, we just, you know, came on and wanted to take some pictures and look around. And he was, you know, he basically said, all right, well, just don't touch anything or don't mess with anything, and then left us there. Imagine that today.
Today, Smith is taking any and all questions about airline travel, including questions from Freakonomics Radio listeners. Have you ever come close to a crash as a pilot?
Close to a crash? I mean, the closest call, if we can call it that, is something that happened to me back when I was, I think, 19 years old, when I was just learning to fly, just a private pilot, when I was involved in a near miss over Nantucket Sound because I was distracted by the beautiful girl sitting next to me. I mean, I've been flying commercially since 1990, and I nothing jumps out at me.
Hi, this is Catherine Hurdle from Bishop, California. I was wondering, is there anything that you have seen while on a flight that you couldn't explain?
I think reading between the lines there that I'm being asked, have I seen a UFO? And the answer is no. You know, I've heard people say, you know, is it true that there's this tacit agreement among pilots that if you see a UFO, you don't say anything? And that just makes me laugh out loud, as if there's a tacit agreement among pilots about anything. I have seen a lot of cool things, though, that I can explain. Views of the Northern Lights, of the Kalahari Desert, the rainforests of Guyana and Brazil. Flying really gives you a sense of how small the world is, and you also see a lot of breathtaking things that leave a disturbing impression. For example, flying over some of the clear-cutting fires of over the Amazon, seeing the just miles-long flame fronts gives you a sense of how much you know, destruction and how much damage we're doing to the planet. You get a good sense of that from the air.
Hi. My name is Tim Wilson. I'm an analytics consultant based in Dublin, Ohio, right outside of Columbus. Reasonably often, I'll be on a flight where we're delayed taking off by 15 or 30 minutes for any number of reasons. But then the pilot comes on, apologizes for the delay, and tells us that he or she is expecting to be able to make up the time during the flight. And a lot of times we do. My question is, what's going on there? Can the pilot really fly faster? And if so, why don't they fly faster normally so that the route is kind of shorter as a normal matter of course?
Well, we can sometimes fly faster, but not as fast as we want. There are air traffic control constraints, of course, and fuel constraints. Flying across the ocean, for example, you have to hit target fuel values at various waypoints as you go along. And if you start to fall behind those target values, that's a problem. And in a worst-case scenario, you could end up having to divert. So we can speed up a little bit, and this is actually more effective on long-haul flights than on short-hauls. Going across the ocean, we could fly at maybe Mach 8.2 instead of Mach 8.0. Usually, though, it's less about flying faster than it is about getting shortcuts from air traffic control.
This does lead me to another question, which is, why don't airplanes go faster generally? It's no faster to fly to California now than it was 30, maybe even 50 years ago. Why is that?
Yeah, the average jet today actually flies a little bit more slowly than it did in 1965. But it flies more efficiently, and there's kind of a conundrum here where the faster you go, the more energy you need. Breaking the sound barrier isn't just a matter of just pouring on the coals and going faster. There are all kinds of aerodynamic complications that come into play. Plus, it uses a lot of fuel. So, no, planes aren't faster, but they are more efficient and they are better. They're much safer than they used to be, much more efficient, much cleaner, much more sophisticated. I try to look at it that way.
Hey, Freakonomics. My name is Zeke. I am a student in Waco, Texas. And my question for the airline pilot is this. Why is there no kid seating on an airplane? It could be at the back of the plane, separated by a thick curtain. And for any parents with young children, they could sit back there and at least spare most of the other passengers with their children's noise. Let's make this happen.
Oh, trust me, Zeke, you don't want to go here. I recently did a blog post on askthepilot.com about whether or not little children should be prohibited from business and first class. And oh my God, the response I got, some of the letters, some of the hate mail I got, I was ready to ask for FBI protection. The almost violently angry letters I got from all the moms and dads out there who thought the idea was just insane. Kids class or family section, maybe that is an idea worth looking into, something akin to the old smoking, non-smoking section. But don't underestimate the hostility that comes with going anywhere near the idea of restricting kids on planes.
Hi, my name is John. I'm an automotive engineer working on self-driving cars, and I live in California in Silicon Valley. How often do you get to fly the plane manually, and do you like giving control to computers? Assuming that you got into flying because you enjoyed doing it, do you still enjoy flying manually, or is it like a chore?
Right, so you're just a guy with a nice white shirt and a couple of stripes and a fancy hat, and you're just sitting up there playing Boggle on your iPhone, I assume, right? You don't actually do anything?
Yeah, where to begin on this, Stephen? This is one of my favorite slash least favorite things to talk about. Cockpit automation, what it is capable and what it is not capable of, is maybe the most misunderstood thing in all of commercial aviation. People have a very exaggerated sense of what the autopilot does and what the pilot's role is in interacting with that automation. The autopilot is not flying the airplane. The crew is flying the airplane through the automation. We still have to tell it what to do, where to do it, when to do it, and how to do it. And when I say how, I mean, for example, just one example of a thousand, setting up and programming, if you will, an automatic climb or descent. There are 6-7 different ways you can do that, depending what you need in the circumstances. And I think people would be very surprised at how busy a cockpit becomes to the point of task saturation, even with all of the automation up and running. Meanwhile, it's true that there's less hand flying, that is, you know, hands on the control wheel, steering almost, than there was, you know, in the 1940s or whenever. But that's okay with me. I mean, I can't imagine the tedium of flying all the way across the ocean and having to have my hands on the steering column the whole time. So pilots have come to rely on a different skill set. But I think it's wrong to say that one skill set is more important than the other, and a certain mastery of both is needed. But manual flight, I mean, whatever that means exactly, I still take off and land my airplane all the time by hand. 100% of all takeoffs are manual by hand, and more than 99% of all landings are made manually by hand by either the captain or the first officer.
My name is Shay Fantonda, and I'm from Cape Town in South Africa. I want to know, is it true that pilots can see you through a camera that's in the bathroom to check if you're up to any funny business?
No. Look, before I answer this absurd question, can I say that Cape Town is one of my favorite cities in the world? And that's saying a lot because I'm not a cities person when I travel. Look, I think we have better things to do than to watch passengers go to the bathroom. No, there's no truth whatsoever to that. Just do your business.
Hey, pilot. I am Darren Pawley, an IT security journalist in Melbourne, Australia. How effective are aviation security measures at stopping terrorism? And if you were in charge, what would you do differently?
Essentially, the real nuts and bolts of airport security is something that goes on offstage, backstage, if you will. It's the job of intelligence, of FBI, law enforcement, Interpol, whoever, you know, people all working together to break up plots before they get to the airport. The security that we see on the concourse is important, but much of what we have in place now, I think, is just irrational and wastes huge amounts of time and money. The big irony here is that the success of the 9/11 attacks really had nothing to do with airport security. I think conventional wisdom holds that the attacks succeeded because the hijackers took advantage of loopholes in airport security, and that wasn't the case. What they really did was take advantage of loopholes in our mindset, that is, our expectations of what a hijacking was and how it was going to unfold. It wasn't about weapons. I mean, the weapons that the guys had, box cutters, knives, whatever they were, it wasn't relevant. They could have used anything. It was all about the element of surprise.
You've talked about passenger profiling as a means of pre-flight security rather than on-site screening. What do you think would work best, most efficiently, to do the job well while not wasting so many billions of person hours?
I think the most important thing we could do is stop looking at every single person who flies as a potential terrorist. It's just an unsustainable approach in a country where 900 million people fly every year. We have to come up with something better. And I'm talking about a system that takes in a whole number of data points and constructs a profile that way. I wish, meanwhile, though, the TSA would get away from its preoccupation with little pointy objects and, you know, whether you have 3 ounces or 3.6 ounces of toothpaste and so on. That obsessing on minutia just drags the whole system down. It's a waste of resources, a waste of time, a waste of money. Also, I think people need to remember that even with all of the emphasis on terrorism and security today, that we used to see bombings and hijackings and airport attacks so much more frequently than we do now. Go back to the 1960s all the way through the 1980s. And, you know, then you had bombings, airport attacks, Lockerbie, Air India, UTA, the TWA bombings and hijackings and so on. This doesn't happen anymore. We're much safer now. And whether that's in spite of or because of the way we do our security is something we could argue about.
Okay, a much, much, much smaller safety question. For years, you guys were telling us that our iPhones could take down a plane if they're left on in our pockets, even dormant. And finally, we were told that apparently our phones can't take down a plane. So what was that process like from the pilot's perspective? What side were you on, and why did it take so long to get to where we are now?
I don't know. I really don't know. There were so many conflicting stories and conflicting reports about what a phone might be able to do, what it can do, what it can't do, what it has done. Anecdotal evidence of phones interfering with certain systems in accidents in the past. Did that really happen? We don't know. You know, I estimate that maybe 50% of all cell phones, whether inadvertently or otherwise, are left on instead of being in the proverbial off position, also known as off. I think if that was really a recipe for any sort of disaster, we'd know about it by now. Now you can have your phone on, but it, only if it's in airplane mode. But on some, you fly on Emirates, you can use your cell phone and make calls just the way you would anywhere. It's still kind of a tangle of policy and regulation that I don't quite understand.
When you fly as a passenger now, do you break any rules like I do? Do you keep your laptop in your seat? Do you not fully unrecline your seat? Do you follow everything that you're told to do, or are you a little bit more freewheeling?
No, I follow the rules. I have to. I have to set a good example. One thing I don't do so much anymore is pay close attention to the passenger safety briefings. I used to make it a point to make eye contact with the flight attendant, or, you know, make it look like I was really focused on that seatback video showing me how to work the seatbelt and so on. Eventually, I decided that if airlines aren't going to, and regulators aren't going to make the effort to streamline those damn presentations, that I'm going to stop paying attention.
You know, it's interesting. We began this conversation with me kind of saying, I empathize with the fact that your industry is unfairly assailed and people complain about this and that. And I realize all I've been doing is asking you exactly those same complaining questions. So I apologize, but I do have another one for you, which is this, Patrick. What can you say about the leadership class of airlines? Does it draw from the highest quality pool that the industry deserves? Or is there something about the airline industry that makes it less attractive or less viable for the best executives?
Well, the airline industry in this country in whole is a lot more stable than it used to be. It used to be very cyclical. It was either bust or boom, bankruptcies and then record profits and then more bankruptcies. I think that the people on the top have figured out how to stabilize that. I think we're going to have a much longer run of profit and stability now than we had in the past. Having said that, what the American carriers need is a visionary. We need a Richard Branson, a Freddie Laker. Do you remember Freddie?
No. Who was Freddie Laker?
He was a Brit. Eventually, he was knighted by the Queen. He started an airline called Laker Airways back in the 70s, and they were the first kind of low-cost, long-haul, no-frills airline. You know, not a comfortable ride, but at the time, a cheap and kind of a fun ride. I mean, he was a celebrity. But somebody who loves the airline business, who grew up with it, somebody like Juan Trip from Pan Am, who would sit in his office looking at a globe and just would pick cities, you know, with his finger and say, that's where we're flying next.
Is that true? Did that really happen?
I've heard that it happened. I don't know if it actually did. But he certainly was a romantic and a visionary. And that only takes you so far if you're going to run an airline, which, of course, is a corporation. But that element, that spirit, is missing from the U.S. airline industry today. I was listening to an interview with Tim Clark, the guy from Emirates, and he was talking about when he was a kid, he loved airplanes, and then he went to work as a gate agent for an airline in the U.K., and just he was so infatuated by the business, and that carries over into his, you know, being able to put this outstanding airline together. And, you know, most U.S. carriers, I think, call from banking and just any of a number of different industries and install those people at the top. And they probably, you know, for the most part, do a good job from the fiscal point of view. But there's something missing that could help make the American airline industry what it used to be. We don't have any global airlines anymore. I mean, United is maybe the closest thing to a truly global U.S. carrier. We fly overseas and basically feed passengers into our code share partners, and they take everybody the rest of the way around the world. We don't have a British Airways. We don't have an Air France. We don't have a Lufthansa, an Emirates, you know, somebody with a truly global presence the way we had once with Pan Am. And, you know, our geography is part of that, but I think more of it is just what our airlines want to be.
Yeah, the minute you said code share partners, it got very unsexy somehow. All right, so two very quick questions to finish up with. As a pilot with a major airline, how does it work for you getting tickets to go anywhere you want? Do you fly free? Is it a discount? Does it work on just your airline or all others? How's that work?
I don't know if I want to answer this, Stephen, because it's
sure
just,
you do, Patrick.
It's complicated. It's
as complicated as the engineering, the aeronautical engineering, and why we're flying slower.
People say, "Oh, you're a pilot. You can fly for free." In fact, all airline employees are entitled to more or less the same flight benefits. Generally, you can ride on your own carrier if there's space, i.e., standby, for nothing or next to nothing. On some international routes, you pay some of the taxes. As pilots, we also have what are called jump seat privileges, where we can ride in the cockpits of other, at least U.S. airlines. But non-revving, as we call it, non-revenue, is unpredictable. A lot of employees, when they go on trips, just buy tickets the way everybody else does because you don't want to have to deal with flying standby can be very nerve-wracking. I could tell you about the time I was stuck in Paris for 3 days trying to get to Cairo and ended up losing my deposit on an Egyptian vacation.
And final question, where are you flying to next as a passenger?
As a passenger? Huh. Well, I have my to-do list of countries. I've got, Bhutan, Uzbekistan, Bolivia, and so on. The list goes on and on. I think I have to get to 100 countries.
That was Patrick Smith, airline pilot. If you have more questions for him, he can be found at askthepilot.com.
I try to answer all of my mail, so anybody who has a question, feel free to ask away.
Coming up next on Freakonomics Radio, flying an airplane is obviously complicated, but parking a car?
Of course, Seinfeld always had episodes about hunting for parking.
Why should I pay when if I apply myself, maybe I could get it for free?
Parking is hell. That's coming up on Freakonomics Radio. And for more episodes like this one, check out our podcast archive on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts, or at Freakonomics.com, where you can also find our books, the blog, and much more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio with your host, Stephen Dubner.
I think, 50 years from now, and people look back on New York and, of course, other cities, that they'll say, what did these people think they were doing?
That's Donald Shoup. He is a college professor at UCLA who is obsessed. Well, it's not really fair to call him obsessed. He is obsessed. He's obsessed with this one thing that we all do all over the world. And that we do so badly, in Shoup's opinion, that someday we'll look back at it the way we now look back at
bloodletting.
Seriously? Bloodletting?
It seemed scientific because there were elaborate tables and diagrams, and it had to be done by surgeons and stuff. It was very harmful. The other comparison, which I think is much more appropriate is lead therapy. Lead was thought to be a wonderful healing device, and it is, because it's toxic to microorganisms, and therefore if you put it on a wound, it would help kill the infection. But people didn't know that it also damaged the brain.
Okay. So what do you think Professor Shoup is talking about? What is this thing we do so badly that future generations will compare it to bloodletting and lead therapy?
Maybe the most mismanaged of all our resources is parking.
Parking?
It's terrible. It's really terrible.
It's crazy. It's horrible. It's way out of hand.
I've driven around for an hour looking for a spot.
Most people don't know what they're doing, and I really want to, like, go out there and be like, I will park your car for you.
Yeah, it's a total nightmare.
Yeah. Parking. If I asked you to name the worst things about modern society, maybe the 10 worst things, I'm guessing that parking would not make your list. Might not even make a top 20 list. And yet, especially if you live or work in a city, you've probably been scarred some point by parking.
I used to park on the sidewalk and get tickets, but there was sort of no other place to go.
Everybody has stories of parking horror that we don't have about stories about horror at grocery stores or with milk or anything else. And they had stories about, you know, even murders over parking spaces.
That's Donald Shoup again from UCLA. He is a transportation scholar who is one of the world's leading authorities on parking. Now, you might think that any right-thinking transportation scholar would study, you know, transport. But as Shoup helpfully points out, the average car spends about 95% of its lifetime parked. Shoup trained as an economist, and his economist roots often show when he talks about parking, because in his view, the biggest problem with parking is the price. Not too expensive, too cheap. He is the author of a nearly 800-page book called The High Cost of Free Parking.
Everybody likes free parking, including me, and probably you. But just because the driver doesn't pay for it doesn't mean that the cost goes away. If you don't pay for parking your car, somebody else has to pay for it. And that somebody is everybody.
Mm-hmm.
We pay for free parking and the prices of the goods we buy at places where the parking is free. And we pay for parking as residents when we get free parking with our housing. We pay for it as taxpayers. And increasingly, I think we're paying for it in terms of the environmental harm that it causes. I did use data to estimate that parking subsidies in the United States are somewhere between 1 and 4% of the total GNP, which is about what we in the range of what we spend for Medicare or national defense.
Mm.
So that's the cost of parking not paid for by drivers.
There are, of course, many different parking scenarios. If you live in a house with a driveway or a garage, parking is a snap, at least when you're at home. In suburban or exurban areas, you've got big, usually free parking lots set back from the street at office parks and malls and restaurants. And then you've got cities, some of which offer free parking right there on the street, curbside. But here's Donald Shoup again to explain why that free parking isn't as free as you think.
If you don't have an off-street space and you have a car and you live in New York, you have to drive around looking for a space, hoping to see somebody going out. There was a study done in New York, a very ingenious method, though simple in retrospect, is that the researchers interviewed drivers who were stopped at traffic lights in Manhattan and Brooklyn and asked them if they were cruising for parking. And on Prince Street in Manhattan, 28% of the drivers said that they were hunting for parking, even though most people were not destined for the area. They were just traveling through the area. So those are people who don't want to be driving. They want to be parked. We did a study here in Los Angeles, lasting a full year, cruising for parking ourselves, going to a destination and then hunting for as long as it took to find a parking space. We made 240 observations. When you add it up, the average time it took to space was only 3 minutes. That's 2.5 times around the block, which doesn't seem like very much. It's about a half a mile. hunting for a parking. But when you add up all the people who are parking in Westwood Village, if they had the same average that we had, that adds up to 3,600 vehicle miles of travel a day. That's the distance across the U.S., and it's just in a 15-block area of Westwood. If you add it up for a year, that's equal to 36 trips around the Earth or 4 trips to the moon, hunting for underpriced curb parking in a little 15-block area. And I think it's happening all over the world. And when other people do these studies, they find very similar results.
I'm just curious, when we talk about urban and suburban sprawl that many people hate, I think, you know, the common image is you're cruising down that street that has a lot of stoplights because there are a lot of turns. There are a lot of turns because there are a lot of shops. There are a lot of shops, and they all have big parking lots. And that whole chain reaction causes a lot of congestion, confusion, accidents, pollution, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When you think of that scenario, how much of that scenario do you think of as caused by the ancient practice of offering free parking everywhere you go?
Well, it isn't ancient. It was
ancient. I mean, 1950s or 1960s. You know,
when, that's right. Yeah, city planners in every city, including large parts of New York, specify the minimum number of parking spaces required for every building, depending on its use. You know, a restaurant typically requires at least 10 spaces per 1,000 square feet, which means the parking lot's 3 times bigger than the restaurant. And if nothing can be built unless it meets that parking requirement, and the parking requirement was established on the assumption that everybody's going to park free, well, it does seem to be kind of self-fulfilling that people drive to it.
Every city has its own parking requirements, but here's a typical scenario. To build a shopping center, you need 4 spaces for every 1,000 square feet of store. A public swimming pool requires 1 parking space for every 2,500 gallons of water. If you want to build a beauty shop, you need 3 spaces per beautician. But a nunnery needs only 1 space per 10 nuns.
The required parking spreads buildings apart, and it makes walking less pleasant. You know, the obvious way to travel is that, you know, we curse traffic and stare at taillights and breathe fumes, and then we expect to park free when we get there. But I think the upside of the mess that we're in is a terrific opportunity that there's all this vacant land that can be built on in cities. I mean, I think we're the Saudi Arabia of developable land in cities. If cities reduced, eliminated their minimum parking requirements, a lot of these parking lots could be built on for infill development.
So as Shoup points out, there are 2 distinct parking problems. In the suburbs, too much land goes to parking because of somewhat arbitrary requirements, and then those areas become harder to navigate and walk in. And in cities, a lot of street parking is either free or underpriced, which leads to too many drivers cruising for spots. This creates even more congestion, pollution, and accident risk.
I think the world would be a lot better if we had never forced people to provide more parking than they're willing to, and if we had charged the right price for curb parking. What is the right price for curb parking? I would say that this is what's been adopted in more and more cities, is that the right price is the lowest price the city can charge and leave 1 or 2 vacant spaces on every block so that nobody can say it's hard to find a space, because wherever they go, they see a space.
That makes sense, doesn't it? At least to an economist. If you're selling something and so many people are trying to buy it that it makes a mess for everyone, you are plainly charging too little. So how do you fix that? Later in the program, we will hear how Donald Shoup and others are trying. But before we go micro, let's go macro. Let's get a sense of just how much parking we're talking about in a country as big as the United States.
There's some cities that the ratio of surface parking is very high. Houston, for example, sometimes could be 30 to 35% of the overall area.
30 to 35% of Houston is surface parking lot?
Of some areas, yes.
A Eran Ben-Joseph teaches urban studies and planning at MIT. He, too, has written a book about parking called Rethinking a Lot, The Design and Culture of Parking. While Donald Shoup is the godfather of parking studies, Ben-Joseph is one of a growing number of what some people call Shoupistas. Ben-Joseph is an Israeli. He's lived and worked all over the world.
Surface lots are the most mundane, cheapest type of parking that you can construct. But I think the best guess that I could give you is that there are about 3 parking spaces for every car in the United States.
Wow.
So, and so that's for the whole country, of course.
And is that including...
And that's only for passenger cars, right?
Oh, my
gosh.
So
if we have 250 million cars in the United States, passenger cars, and you multiply that by about the average of 3, so that brings it to almost 800 million spaces.
Again, is that just surface lots, as you said? Or
those are just surface lots,
and then
yes.
It may be hard to estimate, but what share of total parking spaces would you say that these surface lots constitute?
You know, that's a good one. I think that there's somewhere between, they say, around 70%, 60 to 70%.
Okay, so if you're saying that these surface lots constitute maybe 60 or 70% of the overall parking supply in the U.S., and then if we were to add in, let's say, the rest of that 30 or 40%, we might get to a figure where there are roughly 4 or 4.5 parking spots in America for every car.
Yeah, and some people some people even claim that there are 8.
In case you couldn't tell, Eran Ben-Joseph doesn't like all those surface lots. And not just because of the sprawl. Environmentally, paving over huge swaths of land isn't a very good idea. So, how to do better? Ben-Joseph has some thoughts. At the very least, you could break up huge lots with trees and vegetation. Paint the parking lots light colors so they don't absorb so much heat. Use permeable paving materials to cut down on runoff. Now, to be honest, a lot of academics have neat ideas that they think will fix the world. And most of the time, no one pays attention to them. Michael Manville is an assistant professor of urban planning at UCLA. So we can agree that you are obsessed with the most boring part of car ownership, yes? Parking?
Yeah, that's probably a fair characterization.
Manville got his PhD at UCLA under parking guru Donald Shoup. Scholars like Manville and Shoup argue that if you get the price of parking right, a lot of other problems get solved. Now, some drivers may have to pay more, but they can park where they want to park when they want, which is good for drivers and good for businesses. There'd be less cruising for parking spots, which means less congestion and pollution. But for dynamic priced parking to work, you do need people who are supposed to pay for the parking spots to actually pay for them. And as Mike Manville discovered, that doesn't always happen. He and a co-author ran a study of street parking in Los Angeles, which has the highest auto density of any American city. Manville and his team surveyed thousands of parking meters and found that, and I quote, "At any given time, almost 40% of vehicles parked at meters are both not paying and not breaking any laws." What?
There's 3 reasons why a vehicle could be sitting at a parking meter, not having paid, and not be breaking the law. And so the first one is simply that the meters failed.
Okay.
The other one is government credentials. So that, you know, if you're
My counterfeit FBI placard
exactly.
That I put in my car.
So, yeah, and okay. You know, a lot of places have actual rules that say, you know, if you're a cop or you work for a city council member in a particular car, yeah, you find a way to get a credential. And even in places where it's actually not on the books that these people are exempt from meters, it's like informally, nobody tickets a police officer, right? So that's a share of non-payment as well, legal non-payment. And then the last one and the big one is disability credentials, particularly the disabled placards that are hung from the rearview mirror. At the time we did that study, and I think this has changed a little bit, there was about 25 states where if you had a disabled credential, you could just pull up to any metered space, park for free, and often for very long periods of time.
Okay. What share, roughly, are each of these? Is the handicapped the largest of them?
Yeah, far and away. The disabled placard really was the lion's share, and I think that it's useful to compare that category of non-payment with the sort of traditional scofflaw, you know, I'm just going to park and not pay. And it was twice that. You know, I think normally when we hear about cities losing meter revenue, we just think about, you know, bad enforcement and people aren't paying and nobody's busting them. But twice as many spaces were occupied by vehicles hanging disabled placards as by people who had just sort of chosen not to feed the meter.
Right. So you're saying in the paper that one of the reforms that would help solve this problem of wildly misused parking spaces is ending the practice of granting free time unlimited parking to vehicles displaying disabled placards. When you present a city or when a city learns of your research, do they say, oh, wow, Mike, thanks for solving this for me. Now we know why our parking is such a mess. All we got to do is get rid of all the handicap placards. Does that happen?
Oh, yeah. I mean, people just jump on board this right away. I mean, there's no elected official on earth who doesn't want to remove an entitlement that's at least nominally for a disadvantaged group so that they can charge everyone else more to park. I mean, it's just it's a killer idea. No, of course not. I mean, this is political kryptonite to a certain extent.
Donald Shoup, maybe because he is the eminence grise of parking scholarship, aspires to both camps. He would really like to solve this implacable placard problem.
The placard abuse is just about everywhere, and everybody has a story or many stories about it. 22 UCLA football players were found with disabled placards. So a couple of states have done found a really clever way to get around this. Michigan had a lot of placard abuse, so they have a two-tier system of disabled placards. They revised the law and said that only people who have extreme trouble walking or can't use a meter because they have hand disabilities, only those people are eligible for a special placard that allows free parking at meters. The other people, they could use their disabled placards at disabled spots at grocery stores and things like that. Well, when this law came to effect, only 2% of the people with placards applied for the special placard, which required a doctor's visit and showing that you had a real disability that prevented walking. So it solved most of the disabled placard abuse problem.
And Donald Shoup, as energetic and optimistic as he is, acknowledges that when you try to change how people park, you're going up against a bigger enemy than a strip of asphalt. You're going up against biology.
Of course, Seinfeld always had episodes about hunting for parking. I think one of the quotes I like best from Seinfeld is when I think George and Elaine were driving to Jerry's apartment, and George said, I never pay for parking. Paying for parking is like going to a prostitute.
Why should I pay when if I apply myself, maybe I could get it for free?
And I think so many people are trying to get it for free. You know, we didn't become a great nation by being a bunch of freeloaders and expecting something for nothing. But when it comes to parking, I think, you know, our brains shift down to a lower level of intellectual performance. I think we use the reptilian cortex of our brains, you know, the earliest, most primitive part of the brain that makes fight or flight decisions or how to avoid being eaten or how to get food. And we would say things about parking that we would never say about something we really knew about.
Thanks to Donald Shoup, all of us at least know a little bit more about parking. But the future? That's harder to know. Parking might get worse or, for all kinds of reasons, might get better. The world keeps getting more urbanized, which means more people on foot, on bikes, and mass transit. Maybe car sharing will become more popular, which would lessen parking demand. And most exciting, to me at least, is the future of the driverless car. Now, some smart people think that in 10 or 20 years, most cars will be controlled by computers rather than accident-prone, Instagram-addicted, coffee-drinking, eyeliner-applying human beings. Now, if all cars were driverless, would you still need to own one? Or would you be willing to just summon one the way you now call a cab? It would come pick you up, then drop you off, and instead of having to park at the curb and wait for you, it could come pick me up,
or one of any other million people nearby. And then when you're done doing whatever you're doing, you summon a different car to come get you. How great would that be? And how much less parking would we need? Maybe a lot less. And then comes the really hard part. What do we do with those millions and millions and millions of parking spaces we've built all over the world? More nunneries, maybe? I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. If you can't wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at iTunes, where you can also subscribe.